And it's really lovely to be here tonight. And I would like to thank Ovail and Paul for the invite and the hospitality. And also to congratulate everyone who came up and read. Very hard thing to do when you've just written something. I suppose when I was up in the BEB when I came down today, and I was just trying to think, well, what would be a good poem to start with? And I was trying to settle oneself with kind of an older poem, first of all. But luckily, this one could have been written today. And it's called That July. That July was all portent of autumn. Even on warm days, the sky hung low. It spat and spilt on the darkened town, and the speckle of taillights blurred red as breath condensed on the windows of the bus, where I traced words and shapes with my finger, watched beads of sweat dribble and gather at the strip of black rubber by my elbow. Staring out at this muggy universe of steaming hair and damp clothes, I think I am back at school. I smell new copies and the bus becomes an open page. I'm sure like everyone else, kind of looking at Greece and sort of what's going on there at the moment. And it's such an extraordinary thing in a way. And I find it quite energising, the fact that, you know, a whole population are saying no to some of the stuff that's going on. But it reminded me of an extraordinary article I'd read in Poetry magazine about 3 years ago by the US poet A.E. Stallings, who lived in Greece. And she said that the Greek word for austerity is actually rhymes with the Greek word for murder, which is very interesting. But in the article, she was talking about the creative energy that the crisis necessitated. And she said something which it just struck me again when I read it today, is that poetry is the opposite of austerity, because it's all about abundance, which I just think is a great kind of idea. That's a very spurious introduction to the next poem, and it's called Aspects of Prometheus. I might stick, if anyone's interested, maybe send the link to that article, because it's extraordinary. I mean, she talks about kind of Greek poets, and she talks about Greece as it is. That was about 3 years ago, but it's a very, really interesting article. But this is called Aspects of Prometheus, and it was written in Donegal, where I lived for a while. I squint at the brave February sun and try to gauge how he stole fire. Did he approach the Vulcan's forge with a fennel bulb grasped tight, eyes watering from a molten lava that exhaled with gloop and hiss? Or perhaps it was a splinter of more solid fuel he took, like they once did here from a visited hearth. Here routine still centres on fire, which I awkwardly follow, bending over the squat range to rake the ashes first thing each morning, bringing out warm cinders which gust towards muckish. Later, as I watch hot coal glimmer and shoot stars in the slack, I recall that fire only became mortal when he brought it back, mortal like us and must be tended. Paul was just chatting there about the book Bound for Home, which actually I'm going to read from this copy here, which was an extraordinary thing. I mean, it was so brilliant to get. It was a commission by Cork County Council, and it's a bit of a bugbear of mine in that percent for art schemes and commissions are nearly always for visual artists, whereas the reach that the book has can be much greater for them. But there's a lot of other advantages to it, I think. But anyway, it was a rare opportunity and a brilliant one to get. But I spent a lot of time down in Fort Camden, which I don't know if any of you know, it's the most extraordinary place in Crosshaven. It's well worth a visit. And it's an old military fort, but it's kind of, it's got these incredible ammunition tunnels underneath. So I spent a lot of time there kind of trying to work out what the poems would be about. And I knew I wanted them to kind of be basically animal, vegetable, and human. But one of the ones I really wanted to find a way into was some kind of a sea animal, just because it's a fort kind of on the mouth of the harbour, you know. And I spent ages trying to work out, well, how could I get the voice of a sea animal, what would it be about? And then I found this clipping from the Southern Star, because the other thing about Camden was it was kind of seen as the main defences for the war against the German submarines. So I found this clipping, and this is where the poem came from. Southern Star, January 1915. On Sunday night at 8 p.m., the batteries on Fort Camden in Carlisle opened fire on suspicious objects in the water believed to have been a German submarine. During the firing, two of the shells ricocheted off the water, passing to the mainland of Crosshaven. One burst, but the other didn't. No harm was done by the shells, and nothing has transpired as to the effect of the engagement with the supposed unwelcome visitor to the harbour. Whale song. Squealing and keening, it entered the sea, seeking each breach of defence, echoing beyond its reach. How my soughing and spouting set it off is not known. Ploughing through the sound, I thought I was bound for home. But when the sky darkened at four, I knew I had come too far, out to my glutinous smooth waters. It wheeled past me. Air itself splintered, the sea it cracked from side to side, then bubbled and churned pig iron. So herring smelted and fell in great hissing drops to the sea floor. Song stood still. Listening was lifted on the swell and sucked back into its vacuum. It set off a wave that gathered oceans to itself, collapsed as sound. The other kind of, sorry, can you hear, is that all right? And my, the, the other one that really struck me was, I'd actually, funny enough, I hadn't studied English in university, I actually studied history, so I suppose I was kind of quite, it was the ideal commission, because it was that mixture of you're trying to draw on the history of the fort, but also to turn it into poetry as opposed to kind of documentation, as it were, which I think I succeeded some places, but not necessarily everywhere. But one of the things that fascinated me was the idea that Camden was one of the treaty forts, which meant it was only handed over to the Irish state in 38, I think. But it was left, apparently, with all the silverware polished, the tables laid out, when the British Army walked out and the Irish Army walked in, which really struck me as an extraordinary kind of thing. But also that a lot of the soldiers, the British soldiers, would have left family buried in the graveyard because, you know, the Mary, yeah, in Temple Breedy graveyard. So the two things kind of came together in this poem called Handover. In the belly of the spoon, my thumb dips, makes its circular motion. My breath mists it. I burnish it, till cradled in its curve, my inverted face appears. I catch the familiar dip of her head as she pauses at the window. I twist to her unmisted reflection, but in place of her dear back are streams of laden soldiers who pick their downhill way to the jetty. Then, as if it were the mirror we place to her breath at last, I suck reflected light from the spoon's mouth. And Paul was mentioning One Still Thing, which is my new book that came out. And I suppose it's something I spent a lot of time kind of over the last few years in the National Print Museum in Dublin, which is somewhere else. If you get a chance to go into it, it's an extraordinary place, because they have all the old printing presses there. And they kind of, the retired printers will kind of show you around, and you can actually do letterpress workshops and stuff. But I was laughing, I was saying to somebody, like, the more things go digital, the more I'm attracted to that kind of metal type and the physicality of it. But then somebody pointed out the next logical step would be to carve things in stone. You'd really have to be very careful of your final drafts in that case. But this poem came out of a story that actually a printer had told me, and it's called Printer's Type. Somewhere still, a machine draws red margins on a page like this one. Strung up and dipped in ink, it is a loom for lines. A young apprentice scrubs its colour from his hands, slicks hair back with pomade, and is ready for the dance. Hours later, his girl exits, sweat drew out the ink, his palm imprints her rear. The oncologist too will guess his job by what the x-ray will reveal, but that is years away. For now, head full of the girl, he returns to a trade, busy marking up his future. This was, and again, I mean, I suppose I kind of do tend to get my poems from, they're little snippets of information people give you, and they kind of lodge somewhere. They won't be satisfied until a poem comes out of it. But this was, I'd heard from Ashley Fennell McCafferty that she was trying to feed birds, And she was trying to get birds to feed from her hand, and she said, actually, the best people in Derry to do this are sniper, ex-snipers, because they're the only ones with the patience for it. But the other thing it kind of reminds me of is it's mad. And the other thing then it reminded me of was kind of the whole St. Kevin story. And then, yeah, so it kind of led to a couple of things. So, feeding the bird. It'd take the patience of a sniper or a saint to gain a bird's trust. Outstretched arms 5 months, and so the perch is complete. A cupped palm full of crumbs. The shake, the tremor of muscle holding its own. Hour on hour, each hair alert. Then, before a crack, a stilled breathing, steady and steadier. Months in a ditch, the quiver of a leaf, scratch of wind that give you away to patrol stillness. The pick of a bird's beak, needle sharp on an open palm, retorts out through nervous system, through hedgerow and heart. I teach mindfulness these times, how to focus solely on the task to hand. The other project I worked on, which again was kind of very much letterpress based, was with a print artist, a good friend of mine called Kathy, who, and we decided we'd do something around 36 views of Sugarloaf, so we kind of based it on Mount Fuji, the whole Hakusai thing. But then I was trying to kind of find a way into Japanese poetry, which I'm very interested in anyway. So we worked away kind of separately and together for a while, and some of the poems I'd written had come out of kind of walks I did at the Sugarloaf, and this was one of them, Mist at Dusk, Pig's Hollow, which is a place in the Sugarloaf. Maybe it's the breath of the giant pig that lay, then rose and moved off the lee of the hill, rump swaying, steam rising for Snuggery Lane. Or maybe it's the breath like leaves. Having pitched up, settled on the slope, it shrugs and moves off down the mountainside as night's grasses spring back again. Thank you. That's his first. It's terrible because once you start, then you're going, are you saying that one wasn't? This next one then was written for Kathy, who was a woodcut, made these incredible woodcuts, and it's called Woodcut. And I got fascinated by the tools and the different names for them. Woodcut. The flat scorper glides along the lip of branch, scooping out sky. An astringency of line released, and the thrush sings out in relief. Such sure-footed moons in wood. You, a 7-year apprentice to crutch, to grip, so ligament and intent are one. The key turns smooth in the lock. The forest door swings open, wide. Thank you, that's really
good. Now we're getting it.
The other, there were a couple of those poems that came out of that. Another one was Literal, which kind of, there's the whole, the notion of coast in any way. I mean, it actually came more from the kind of sound of the word, so it's literal. Rain has bitten away much of this month, but left us this foot-lifting morning, glistening. It's evening ahead like an open palm or attenuated mind. Above us, ridges, where each next sighted peak promises renewal. The city coasting in its bays. And the sight of the seas reveals a father on the sand, his last child in his arms. Look, waves, waves, like this. Steps forward and extends his hand so their wrists flex over thresholds of meaning. And they stand as land and water seem. The other one actually, which I heard is incredible, and it was actually a true story of a friend of mine who lived, she'd kind of been brought up on the slopes of the Sugarloaf, so it was like a playground, and she told me this story about her Uncle Johnny, and it's fairly literal, so I'll just read it. It's called Sown. The hills are buttered with gorse, wrote Eileen's Uncle Johnny, before a freak wind took, tossed to the sky the whole body of his shed. Lucky for me, he thought, it wasn't nailed to the floor, for that would have been that. He sat as overhead a flock of pages caught in an updraft of dispersal, rose over Joust, Kipure, Three Rock, then dropped. A lifetime's work mulched under. The year sped red its seasons till gorse was at it again, and from each hill a crop of words had spread. Again, I was just talking to Paul about kind of the B&B where I am, which is right beside Marymount, which is kind of, because my father would have passed away there, and then, but the day he passed away, I actually heard the story of my namesake, which I'd never known, which was my great aunt, Nell Regan, who again, I didn't realise I was named after. So I heard the story that she'd gone to America to meet her fiancé, who was the good friend of my grandfather, and he never turned up. And she stayed in America, and then she got TB. Very sad story, and came back, even though she was advised not to. And when I went over to America about 2 or 3 years ago, I wanted to write a piece about it, but not necessarily by, you know, I didn't want to actually research kind of her steps, as it were, but I wanted to kind of take that story with me and see, you know, what would become of it. So it became a long poem, which is kind of the heart of this collection, called Passage. And one of the places that fascinated me was a place in Iowa. Oh no, actually, yeah, I was trying to work out how would you kind of deal with the character of the fellow who never turned up? And so I was kind of thinking skyscrapers, New York, and I was thinking, what's the furthest, deepest down you can get? Because you really want to send someone to a bad end, really. And I was thinking about, I read something about the New York Federal Reserve, Gold Reserve, which is like really deep in the earth. So I actually, bizarrely enough, was Googling it. And then they said, do you want to go on the next tour of the Gold Reserve? So I said, yeah. So I actually, you can just turn up and go on a tour of the Federal Gold Reserve. So it's incredible. You go down this lift, down, down, down. And literally, there's this kind of cavern with all the gold bullion. So it's quite a bizarre experience. But so I sent him down there, anyway. I figured that was fair enough. And he gets locked in. Gold, midnight, New York Federal Reserve. And it's kind of around sometime in the 20s. No dawn down here, no dawn in the deep rock of the island. This rich load of bricks, all handled, hawked from cell to numbered cell. The vault door cumbered like a ship's turn at sea, its ballast gold. The cylinder lifted a quarter inch, sealed me in, 8 floors below. Quiet down here, quiet. Who knew bullion could be so still, breathless, resting, caged? Yet the exact calibration of human skin, its sheen, its luster, its steady lustering. Once, to sense a warmth, I took off my glove and kneeled it as a jeweler would, a lover's palm stroking an arm, a breast. My fingertips stirred by what emanates, but the squeal of the trolley wheel takes me back to my day's labour, as according to transactions enacted above, we load and unload gold. We are all brickies down here, building, unbuilding walls of bullion. Always use the stone you lift, my father said as we stood before the dry wall, make it fit. And what would he make of this, a prison for all this wealth? The other place that fascinated me in the States, and again it's just these kind of little bizarre quirks, was this place called Muscatine in Iowa. And actually I decided that she should really go there. Dusk, August, Muscatine, Iowa. Dear Paddy, this comes direct from the pearl button capital of the world, no lie, but a scut of a place in truth. Muscatine, on the banks of the wide Mississippi rolling by, gripped by a gold rush of its own, muscle as they flock here to haul from the riverbed, the mother lode, mother of pearl. Imagine mallow possessed, each alley and street heaped with middens of discarded cut shell. The rotted flesh feeds hogs or clogs the drains, while day and night the fine and bite of cutting machines enters the mind, spitting out button blanks, clouds of dust. 10,000 tons a year leave here. The world has become a button of shell which I stitch to a card. And then, I suppose in the story, I kind of stuck to the vague outline where she gets TB, and then she decides to go home, you know, despite kind of medical advice. I'd say it kind of feels like full circle today, because I'm kind of outside Maryland, it's strange. I'll just read the last. As night weaves moon, rivers lit by shell, so I dream in shell, dreaming what mussels dream, scenes of dusky light for the roof of my skull, so the sky is a skull, where dusk dreams of purling reflected moons, as they river through shell, and mother of dusk becomes daughter of pearl, and I dream of horror that would sail me home down the spine of America. I spent the best part of a year in the States, kind of about 3 years ago, and I suppose just fascinated by the range of experiences in America. But one of them was, it's one of those forms you try and try and try, and you sometimes manage to do it, but I was very proud of this one because it actually worked. It's a Sestina, which is kind of like a five-word challenge. And then some. You pick, I don't know if you know about it, you pick six words and then you have six verses with six words as their end, the end of each line in different combinations, and then the last three lines have all the six words in it. So the end words here, river, trees, poem, cicada, longing, and bridge. And it's Iowa City, Sestina. This town is stitched by river that finds and winds its way through trees whose leaves curl yellow, and every poem is found to contain it, them, and cicada call. Perhaps they too stand for longing, forded by an imagined Atlantic bridge. Outside my window, the bridge of green wrought iron spans the river, asks what is there to miss. It will not be long, love, till you find me under this tree, straining to describe the cicada song that is shot through this poem. Each avenue of the city a walking poem, considered views that yield to bridges over which the chatter and clatter of cicada curls and pulls time forward in a rivering flow, while leaf considers tree and the blue reflection of sky is longing for river. Just as water is longing for colour, much as word yearns for poem or its echo in a lover's ear. The tree stands alone, says desire less. Bridge with what you have here, and the river will carry to you all the cicada pulse and call of a continent. Wish cicada timble on the banks of all Iowas along the Mississippi, as it rivers out through prairie, plain, and poem. The pitched sow of the train that bridges the night freights stories of cornfield, of oak tree, to the city's gridded morning, where trees anoint the grass with shade, students read, cicada conversations fade. Later, stepping to the bridge, the Capitol dome will throw its gold reflection, elongating the reach of a September dusk, where a poem or thought might constellate. Deep in the river, open-mouthed carp gape over trees, long branches pooling on its ceiling while cicada poem clicks, calls forth a silent bridge to span the river. Just read two more poems, and for me, that's one of the things I love about poetry. You put everything into it, history, yeah. Science, nature, love, everything, you name it. And this was, I was kind of fascinated, how do you get kind of scientific theories, I suppose, into poems? And this is called Silence, but they don't, it's funny, it honestly, it's like it occurs to you as you're writing the poem as well. I didn't set out to do that. It's called Silence. Seeking purchase on the balcony rail, finding the solemn note of the steel girder, damping into wooden boards, as little symphonies flutter on the tin chair. The rain is falling, picking out each surface and calling it back. If a poem displaces the weight of its sound in water, then let these loosened drops brim out over the edge of night, evaporate and fall again to call back a summer image of where I lie without you, and let a singing line begin. One last poem. Rain has loosened itself. Rain has loosened itself from the sky and overhead become intimate with scent, with song, with the sky, with the sigh of a branch brushed by the beat of a wood pigeon's wing. So, before we set our glasses down, these plump minutes on the sofa, looking out at a lengthening dusk, demand a grammar of their own, making as they do a cover of last light, under which we call and respond, translate the what has been into a yet to come. Thank you.